A body snatcher is a grave robber who takes a body out of a grave.
And in the not-so-distant past, a body snatcher might also have been a medical student. I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
You measure a sample, but you measure millions and billions of molecules all at the same time.
You get to see these patients over and over again. They become part of your family.
It's a virus that likes to attack lots of different organ systems.
You know, everything falls apart.
How about a bag of frozen peas to keep you comfy? Plus,
bingo.
So here's this population that never gets studied.
Pretty much all of cell biology
there
needs to kind
be
of be redone.
For
I first
tests.
Opened a little
this
box
before
and there was
cells.
A cell.
All
G-flow
of the surgeries have not been prior to 1947.
We're just giving some of the medicine to your IV.
Basically, we wanted to know if there was any point to doing it.
Today's show is all about the human body, more specifically, what happens to us after we've taken our last breath. Dead bodies serve as teachers in medicine and science. They reveal knowledge and insights for each generation of researchers and physicians. We'll talk about the science of autopsies, take a look at what comes of unclaimed bodies, and explore why some religions guard their dead. To get started with today's show, let's head to Rowan University's School of Osteopathic Medicine in New Jersey. We're about to witness a beautiful annual ritual. It marks a rite of passage for doctors-to-be.
All right, everybody, welcome. As you guys know, this is we just like to take an afternoon at the spring near the end of our anatomy dissections to honor and remember the people who donated their cadavers to our educations.
150 med students have come together to pay their respects to people they know almost nothing about. Not their names, their lives, their families, but they do know that these people have given their bodies to be used in education. They're singing, prayer, and poetry.
A time to be born and a time to die. A time to plant.
As you chose to walk down in life, but I have felt the fibers of all the muscles that carried you there. I do not know what made your heart burst with love, but I have pictured how the blood flowed through the four chambers of your heart.
And at the very end, all of the students take part in one last act. Med student Tamir Rauf is emceeing the ceremony.
We'll take a moment of silence to share with your dissection teams and your cadavers before we all part ways.
The students then place white carnations and daisies across their cadavers' chests. A few moments pass, and then they head out, back to the med school grind. Here's Rauf again.
This is kind of a one-way street in terms of what's been done for us, and we need to find ways to make the sacrifice that these people made worth it.
Rituals like this, respectfully honoring the person behind the cadaver, are really common in med schools these days.
But it wasn't always this way.
This is Pulse reporter Alana Gordon. She's been digging into this history.
Because once upon a time, bodies were not so easily available.
In early European history, dissection was a crime worthy of hanging. In the United States, it was never technically illegal, but there were no official pathways to donate your body to science, and also nobody wanted their body to be cut open and examined. And so doctors and students resorted to some pretty seedy and even extreme measures to get bodies to practice on.
It all came to a head in Philadelphia in the late 1800s.
For this part of the show, we're collaborating with the podcast Criminal, a Pulse favorite, to bring you the curious story of a legendary outlaw and a big change in the culture of dissection in America. Alana takes it from here.
Evie Newman is looking for a brain, and more specifically, the brain of a one-eyed horse thief.
I would really love to find his brain. I hope that it's out there.
Newman is an exhibits manager at the Mütter, an old anatomical museum in Philadelphia that has skulls, tumors, and all sorts of body parts on display.
This gallery is organized by body part.
She's from Greece, but she calls this place home.
So we start with brains and go into hearts, lungs, and around the room to limbs.
Her nickname here is the wet specimen hound. She's good at finding preserved body parts in jars. What is it? It's green.
It's a brain with a large meningioma, which is a tumor of the brain covering.
But this brain that she's looking for went missing 120 years ago. And the scene of the crime, if you could call it that, Eastern State Penitentiary. This was Pennsylvania's world-famous prison all throughout the 19th century. Now it's a coveted ruin that attracts hundreds of thousands of visitors. The story goes that on January 21st, 1896, a prisoner at Eastern State named Alexander Leipzig, though some reports refer to him as Leipzner, went to check on his sick friend, John Frankford.
He seems to think very highly of Frankford. Apparently he was well-liked.
Frankford had been suffering from a badly infected dog bite. He also had terrible stomach cramps. So he was staying in the hospital wing, cell block 3, supposedly falling in and out of consciousness. It was a cold morning. It was snowing.
So Alexander looks for Joe Frankford, and he looks all over the place.
What Leipzig claims he saw next in the courtyard right by the hospital froze him in his tracks.
He sees across the yard a table with his friend's naked body on it. And the doctor, the prison physician, is working on him. That's how he describes it.
Frankford is dead. Leipzig inches closer.
But he tries not to be seen. He doesn't want to be discovered. And he sees Dr. Bacon remove Frankford's heart. And he puts that on the snow, presumably to keep it fresh. And then he's working on his skull, and he opens up the skull and takes out the brain, and he sets that on the snow too.
This is the story according to a deposition Leipzig later gave to authorities. Newman's coworker found the document by chance at a flea market in 2014, and it really struck Newman. She's always been drawn to stories inside these prison walls and the notion of personal autonomy even after death. She spent hours transcribing the faded antique cursive. She reads from it.
Afterwards, I saw the doctor go up through the seventh block to his office with the bucket in which were the various parts he had removed from the body. Two more other convicts who saw this, whose names I can give.
Frankfurt's daughter, Maggie Rittenhouse, didn't know about any of this post-mortem activity when she came in from Lancaster, Pennsylvania, to pick up her father's body the next day. The official cause of death? Strangulated hernia, which he had been suffering from for some time. But something wasn't right.
And when they get the body, he has bruises all over his body. He has sewn marks, and the body is mangled because, of course, if organs are missing and his skull is cut open, it's really hard to hide that.
The daughter was deeply disturbed. Had her father been murdered? An investigation begins, because John Frankford wasn't just any criminal. He was a famous horse thief.
I imagine him kind of a horse whisperer, because he steals horses. To do that, you have to be able to approach a horse and get it out of its yard or keep without it making noise.
Frankford, supposedly a handsome guy with dark features, crossed the region from Ohio to Maryland, skirting sheriffs, stealing and selling horses. But his real notoriety came from his mastery at jailbreaking.
Frankford had the reputation of just not taking prison seriously. There's actually an article whose headline is, "He laughed at iron cells." So he's kind of an incredible figure. I almost admire him in a way.
One time, the keeper at Lancaster County Jail shot Frankford in the face during his elaborate attempt at escaping through the jail's stone chimney. The bullet swiped his eye. He lost sight in it. And so he gained the nickname One-Eyed Joe. Frankford met his match, so to speak, when he sent to Eastern State Penitentiary to serve out a 19-year term for horse theft. Eastern State's a mighty castle-like fortress. It's where solitary confinement basically originated. Frankfurt was nearing the end of his term when he died, and even though he'd been locked away for well over a decade, his obit was front page news. Later, during the trial over his death, Frankfurt's friend Leipzli gave his testimony, as did the undertaker, the prison warden, and of course the head doctor, John Bacon, a graduate of the prestigious University of Pennsylvania. Newman reads from a newspaper account from the trial.
"Why did you take out the brain?" Dr. Bacon was asked. "Because John Frankfurt was a typical criminal, and I wanted the brain for scientific purposes." And he added that this was frequently done.
The news reports say Dr. Bacon admits to taking Frankfurt's brain for science. And then it's reported that he admits to taking the brains from two other bodies.
When I picture this trial, I kind of picture Dr. Bacon being kind of defensive about it, saying, "Of course we did this."
I talked to a researcher at Eastern State Penitentiary about this account, who was surprised, skeptical even of this story, because the prison doesn't have any records of doctors taking organs for study. But other medical historians say it all would have been very under the table, and it would have fit into the broader practices that were rampant.
At the same time, the public consciousness is very aware of body snatching.
Yes, body snatching.
Our show today is about our bodies after we've taken our last breath. Alana Gordon is exploring a dark chapter in medical history, and we'll get right back to that after our break. Later on the show, we'll talk about how the supply of bodies is managed today and how science is learning from bodies. Stay tuned to The Pulse.
A body snatcher is a grave robber who takes a body out of a grave.
Michael Sapel is a historian who's written a book all about this.
They could also be called a resurrection man. The body snatcher term is mainly associated with medical grave robbery.
During the 1700s and 1800s, these resurrectionists made a killing digging up corpses and selling them to medical schools.
There are a few notorious examples of times when it became so lucrative that body snatchers actually murdered people in order to supply the anatomy department.
Now that was the extreme, but doctors and students had a problem. They needed bodies to dissect, to learn, but there wasn't an easy way to get them, at least enough of them. And when you think about it, the experience was really important back then. You had Civil War soldiers returning from battle, the emergence of the ambulance, new surgical techniques. Again, Evie Newman with the Mütter Museum.
How could you learn otherwise? Especially at the time when there is no medical imaging. There are no x-rays, no MRIs, no scans of any sort. So to see what's wrong with someone, you have to open them up.
This was also a time when medicine and even the broader public had an intense fascination and curiosity with the body. You had the rise of anatomical museums, like the Mütter, that would get unusual body parts and display them for study. Doctors amassed their own private collections. Contrary to nowadays, Michael Sapel, that historian who's written about this, says there was a huge stigma back then about being dissected for medical education, or even being autopsied, because how you were treated after death was really important.
This is also a time in American culture where how you die really matters to people. And if you're a poor person and you're saving money, the money you might be saving would be dedicated to your death.
Dissection for centuries back was often listed as an added punishment to those sentenced to execution. The easiest bodies to snatch were those of the poor and vulnerable, who didn't have money for cemetery security or a protected grave. These were African Americans, immigrants, those buried in potter's fields or who died in asylums and prisons. There was also an urgency to get bodies. Preservation science hadn't really advanced yet, so bodies would decompose fast. In the early days, even students sometimes got directly involved in stealing them.
Well, some of them get the bodies by going to the cemetery themselves to get them.
Meaning, like, they just ask for them? Like,
no, meaning they go in the dead of night and they might bribe a watchman or maybe get a watchman drunk, or maybe they just look for the moment when the watchman falls asleep. And they bring in their wagon with their horse and dig and unearth a body and then away.
That sounds horrific to me, and I would imagine to a med student today. What was different then?
Well, part of it was this is a rite of passage. First of all, imagine the medical students back then tend to be younger. It's a culture of camaraderie and bravado. You want to curry favor with the professor? Bring the professor a body. Bring the professor an interesting body. You want to curry favor with your fellow classmates? I got a body. They are impressed with you. You're a brave, strong lad.
These students weren't always respectful in how they handled the bodies. And when the public caught wind of the unruly activity, riots would break out. In some instances, only being locked in jail could protect students from community outrage and even death.
Every medical school in the United States has a body snatching scandal. And there's a lore of body snatching in every medical school.
By 1878, the popular press reported at least a dozen body snatching scandals in America. And in 1882, just before that famous horse thief, John Frankfurt, was captured for the last time, when Philadelphia was exploding with medical schools whose reputations rose or fell on whether they had bodies for students to dissect.
I knew you would be asking us about Dr. Forbes. It's a pretty amazing story.
This is Michael Angelo. He's the archivist at Thomas Jefferson University.
Dr. William Forbes, the foremost anatomist in the country here at Jefferson Medical College, had a relationship with some people who supplied cadavers for the students. The local Philadelphia papers knew that something was fishy, so they basically set up a sting.
It was at a very large African-American cemetery. The crew camped out at night, armed with guns, ready to catch the crime in action.
And so you could call them muckraking journalists, no offense. But they actually got to the bottom of this because there were bodies being stolen every winter from these cemeteries. And so when they arrested these individuals, they squealed and said Dr. Forbes was the man who asked them to bring the bodies.
A mob stormed the courthouse. But Forbes never admitted to knowing this was going on. Think of it as a don't ask, don't tell when it comes to where the bodies came from for his lab.
But the damning evidence was that there were keys to the dead house, or the place where the corpses are kept at the college, in the possession of those men. And we actually have the keys in the archives today, so it's kind of a grisly reminder of where America was 130 years ago.
Forbes is exonerated. He returns to his medical post amid a mix of outrage by some in the community and relief in the medical world. Ironically, Forbes, now at the center of a major body snatching scandal where allegedly he had been fueling the trade, had been a leader 15 years earlier in trying to set up a legal way for schools to get bodies so this wouldn't happen. He had penned Pennsylvania's first law to provide schools with, quote, unclaimed bodies. But it was weak and it was hard to enforce. So Forbes then uses the Jefferson scandal as leverage to push through state legislation that would actually create a legal mechanism for schools to get bodies.
So as Philadelphia went, so did the rest of the country. The Anatomy Act of 1883 was a really important landmark for the entire country.
State laws regulating bodies for dissection were all over the map back then, if they even existed at all. Massachusetts was an early pioneer. In Pennsylvania, this act made it mandatory for certain bodies to go to anatomists, essentially legitimizing dissection in the U.S. And it did so by setting up an actual agency that would oversee the distribution.
If you go to the state archives in Harrisburg, from around 1890s onward, they have records of bodies of prisoners who have been executed or indigent people, once again, unfortunately, who are unclaimed, where they indicate the person, their age, what they died of, and what medical school they were sent to. So it became a real kind of organized, rational, with a board making decisions.
The Pennsylvania Anatomy Act turned into Forbes's crowning accomplishment. And it was pushed through thanks to a state senator, who also happened to be a surgeon in northwestern Pennsylvania, who years earlier had been convicted of body snatching. But what about body parts? Back to the case of One-Eyed Joe, our legendary horse thief. The Anatomy Act is referenced because it came out just a few years earlier. But in news reports, it appears his case kind of falls through the cracks of it. Again, here's Evie Newman from the Mütter Museum, who's been following this case.
There is no clause of the Anatomy Act that talks about organs. That's never mentioned. So it appears that if you can get away with taking organs, you can. The end of the reporting of the trial actually reviews the prison as almost not responsible for this. And there isn't really retribution for it.
Shortly after the trial, Dr. Bacon leaves his position at the prison. But Newman says One-Eyed Joe probably wasn't technically snatched for regular dissection, because during that time, there might have been a keen interest in organs for other reasons.
So my guess is that they had their eye on him. This is a famous horse thief. At the time, the idea of criminal physiology and phrenology is fairly alive and well in the United States.
Newman is referring to the old popular study of the brain that gained a lot of interest in the 19th century. It's the idea that physical characteristics of the brain, like bumps, could reveal differences, so criminality could be identified in the brain and studied. There's also just a general fascination with unusual body parts, like those on display at the Mütter, and those of famous people, of criminals, for collector's sake, not even for science.
Like collecting, you know, Charles Guiteau's brain, who was the assassin of President Garfield.
Or that of pirates, murderers, or perhaps a famous horse thief?
I would really love to find his brain. I hope that it's out there. There is no real footnote about where it ended up. We don't know if it was sold by Dr. Bacon, if Dr. Bacon kept it, if it was returned to the family. There is no mention of what actually happens to his organs. So my hope is that Dr. Bacon sold it to one of his colleagues and it ended up in a collection and it's still somewhere out there in Philadelphia, hopefully.
How would you know?
It would probably be marked as the brain of a horse thief.
Why do you want to find this brain?
Just to complete the story, to get some sort of resolution. I always believed that seeing like an open casket funeral or the remains of your loved one brings a sense of closure. And this horse thief from, you know, the turn of the century has become a fixture in my life for the last 2 years. So I want to follow the story to the end and see what became of him.
The one image Newman has of Frankfurt is a sketch in his obit. I've seen it. In it, Frankfurt looks so melancholy to me, Like, as he once told his daughter, life is not your own inside Eastern State. But when I look closer at that one eyelid of his, slightly drooped over the eye he can't see out of because of a bullet that swiped him during an escape, it sort of looks to me like maybe he could be winking. Like maybe this is One-Eyed Joe's final way of getting away from us all. His last great escape. For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
The Pulse collaborated on this story with the podcast Criminal. To learn more about One-Eyed Joe and his life, check out their episode this week. It's on iTunes. Hearing about this history of bodies for dissection has brought up all kinds of questions around what happens to us after we die and how medicine has changed. Until the 1940s and 50s, med schools still relied mostly on unclaimed bodies for dissection and research. But today, thousands of people donate their bodies to education every year. There was a major cultural shift in how we look at the body after death, especially around World War II. People gave a lot of blood, they donated corneas, and eventually, when surgeons started to transplant organs successfully, there was a need for more legislation around the use of bodies and tissues. Joining us now is attorney Christina Strong. She teaches at Rutgers Law School. I asked her to explain how the distribution of bodies is regulated today.
Human bodies, in order to be used for any of the things they can be used for, transplant or therapy or research or education, need to be the subject of a gift. And that's governed in every state by a law called the Uniform Anatomical Gift Act. And there are parts that you can give, which includes your whole body or various parts. And you can restrict. You can say, I'm very comfortable with organ donation, but I'm not comfortable with the donation of my eyes. Or, I only want to donate my eyes. I'm not comfortable with the other parts. So you have that ability to, in a very simple way, much simpler than a will, make your gift right now, and it's binding. No one can overturn it after you die.
And the laws are not very different from state to state, right?
No, they're pretty much, they were designed to be uniform because organs are a national resource. Congress has declared them to be that. So we needed to have some uniformity to make sure that if someone dies in New Jersey and someone in Philadelphia is going to die if they don't get their heart, that we can get this across state lines in a way that is ethical and sound.
If I want to give my body to education, I can give it, but I cannot sell it, right?
In Pennsylvania, you cannot sell your body for education. In most other states, you could. You can't sell organs and you can't sell tissues under federal law for transplant. But whole bodies is not subject to that federal prohibition. So states, state by state, have made a decision whether or not to regulate that. But it doesn't really happen anywhere because the medical professionals involved don't want to be part of a market in cadavers, essentially.
But there is money that exchanges hands for these bodies, correct?
Well, there is, whether it's for transplant or research, which again, there isn't this federal prohibition, there's always costs involved. I'm an attorney who works for these entities. I get paid by these entities. Some are for-profit, some are non-profit. There's very skilled professionals who interface with families, who actually recover the organs. Tissues need to be processed prior to transplant. They need to be stored. They need to be distributed. So there's a lot of professionals involved.
What if it was just possible for me to sell my body? Why shouldn't I just say, you can have my body, do whatever you will with it after I'm dead, and you pay me $80,000?
Or my estate, $80,000.
Yeah.
I don't know of any any company that is formed as a willing participant in that. And I think it goes back to the culture we've created where this is a precious resource. This is a legacy that you can give. If we have to pay you for it, then you should probably take it with you. But if you want to leave a legacy to the benefit of humanity, then it's a gift. And I think that is deeply our cultural understanding ever since bodies started to become something that we donate as opposed to something that the state or the church just takes.
There are offers included, though. For example, we will take care of your cremation costs.
Right.
So does that walk a fine line?
Well, it's interesting. So if you donated after you died your liver and kidneys, I could not pay for your cremation because that would be buying, giving you something valuable in exchange. But I kind of have to cremate your body after you've donated it for science. It is not something that is suitable for viewing or even for a lot of transport. So it's legal for whole bodies for education, but you're right, it wouldn't be legal for livers and kidneys. And people talk about this and debate this when you think of the value to the recipient of life. It would seem appropriate, a lot of people think, to be able to give you something in return to recognize the benefit to society, like your burial expenses. But we don't want to entice anyone to make this gift. So it's an interesting moral conundrum.
Christina Strong is an attorney in New Jersey. This is The Pulse. We tell health and science stories from all over the country. I'm Mike and Scott, and today our show is about the body after we've taken our last breath. Hospitals used to be required to perform autopsies on at least 20% of patients who died on the premises. Many autopsied more, but in 1970, the requirement was lifted. Autopsies are expensive, and the numbers have been plummeting ever since. It can be hard to ask families to sign off on the procedure, insurance often doesn't cover it, and technology has made doctors increasingly trusting in their diagnoses. But still, many physicians are pushing for more autopsies. Irina Zhorov attended one to learn why.
How much does he weigh?
170.
Perfect. Wish I weighed 170.
Dr. Robert Owenby, a pathologist who heads up the Hahnemann Hospital Autopsy Unit in Philadelphia, suits up in a blue plastic gown and latex gloves before approaching the patient on the metal table.
He's a 64-year-old gentleman, and his only significant history is hypertension and Parkinson's for 30 years.
The man died 3 days ago. Owenby, a team of residents, and a technician whose job it is to do the actual cutting are investigating what killed the man and what was going on in his body at the time of death. The procedure is incredibly hands-on.
You use four of your five senses. You can guess which one you don't use.
The residents do a physical exam, feeling for abnormalities. When they're ready to cut, they cover his face with a blue towel. Concealing his gaze feels appropriate somehow. Fred Radhoff, the technician, makes a Y incision, two diagonal cuts on the chest and one down the belly.
I'm going to take this down to the pubis, go around the umbilicus.
He's wearing a mask, so he's a little muffled. Owenby tracks his progress as Radhoff pulls back the skin with its layer of yellow fat tissue to reveal the bowels.
You may detect an odor.
Radhoff prepares to remove the rib cage. He tells a student it's okay to draw a line along which to saw.
Many people will do this to give themselves a guide. I've been doing it so long, I really don't need it.
He's been doing this for nearly 20 years. He uses what's called a striker saw. It cuts bone, but not flesh. And a favorite trick in the autopsy room is to put the spinning blade to your palm and freak out first-timers like me. Radhoff opens the chest cavity to reveal the heart and lungs.
Nice lungs.
Yeah, really. Nice and pink.
Non-smoker? Wow.
Doctors suspected a stroke killed him, but couldn't confirm. The patient's family requested an autopsy to clarify what happened and see if there were any genetic problems they should be aware of. Doctors told me for families, the final autopsy report brings closure. For doctors, it's quality control and education.
We often find things that are unexpected at autopsy.
Studies show that autopsies turn up contradicting causes of death. For example, a doctor blames pneumonia, but an autopsy reveals that it was actually a tumor.
That's despite the fact that we have all this technology, this wonderful imaging that's very specific, all these different types of lab tests.
Doctors can also see how a treatment like chemo, for example, affected a patient. From what they learn, they may approach similar patients differently in the future. Radhoff suctions out fluid and scoops out organs to give to the residents working across the room. He takes them out in blocks so the pathologist can check for problems in the connections between organs. Adeola Tomiolugbodi, a third-year resident in pathology, weighs, measures, feels for abnormalities, and slips the organs into a solution to prepare them for lab work.
We're contributing to the body of science from what we find.
It's very clinical. Almost makes you forget you're dealing with a person. Still, ONB gets that none of that is enough to convince some people to send loved ones to autopsy. I ask him if he wants one when he goes.
I've gone back and forth about that, to be honest. To some extent, for myself anyway, religion and the mystery about what happens after death comes into play. Am I going to need my organs when when that happens? Realistically, of course, no. But yeah, I think I would probably want an autopsy performed.
He says they do everything possible to accommodate families with similar sensitivities. But where loved ones are concerned, even science may not answer every question. As for this patient, it'll be a couple of months before the team issues a complete autopsy report with their findings. For The Pulse, I'm Irina Zhorov.
One is the loneliest number that you'll ever do. Two can be as bad as one. It's the loneliest number since the number one.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about the legacy of our bodies after we've died. What happens when somebody dies alone? When a body is found, but there is no sign of family or friends? This is a predicament big cities face all the time. In Philadelphia, it happens more than 250 times a year. Reporter Bobby Allen traces the path an unclaimed body takes.
At Laurel Hill Cemetery in North Philadelphia, there are a couple of small patches of grass in the center of the sprawling 78-acre site that are easy to miss. But the almost cryptic message on the headstone there draws your attention, making you think, wait, really?
All it says is something simple, 1,500 citizens consigned to Earth, City of Philadelphia, 2010.
Cemetery Superintendent Bill Duran, originally from Ireland, has an unruly mop of hair, bright blue eyes, and a kind of mellowness that just might come with looking after the cemetery's scenic slopes for three decades.
All that really means is that we buried 1,500 people in 2010, and they were all Philadelphia residents. Basically, all it is a permanent marker. This just personalizes it.
It's hard to truly personalize the cremated remains of 1,500 people who city officials knew almost nothing about, but the headstone is at least an acknowledgement. Right next to it, another 515 unclaimed remains have been buried and will be getting a headstone this month. Genealogist Megan Smolenik has dedicated her whole life to trying to figure out why so many people die alone, with relatives elusive and friends unable to track down.
Sometimes somebody just winds up unclaimed because they're the wanderer in the family, and it takes 2 years before somebody wakes up and says, hey, we haven't heard from Joe. What's up? You know, what's happened to him?
She says friends drift apart, families feud, which can be isolating. Someone moves to another city and becomes homeless. A person dies of old age and isn't survived by anyone. Or someone emigrated to the U.S. alone.
And this is maybe the saddest thing of all. There are people who really do care, but they're just too darn poor to do anything about it.
In other words, someone gets a call that a friend or relative has died and that they could pick up their cremated remains, but it's a stressful proposition. Duran says this happens all the time.
The minimum funeral today is $5,000, $6,000, $7,000, and there's quite a lot of people in Philadelphia that can't afford that kind of money.
A plot costs money, the actual burial is costly, an undertaker and other staff need to get paid. The most common reason remains are never picked up is that a family can't afford the cost of burial. And that means the city is left with hundreds and hundreds of unclaimed remains. Here's how a body moves through the system. When a dead body is found, a county coroner or medical examiner immediately gets involved. Philadelphia is on the medical examiner system. If next of kin doesn't step forward or can't be found after 36 hours, a body is legally unclaimed in Pennsylvania. It's then stored in a refrigerated morgue for 3 months, allowing families that much time to pick up their loved one. After the three-month period, the city will cremate and keep those cremains for 10 years. When they really start to accumulate, Durin from Lauren Hill Cemetery will get a call. Soon after, he'll drive his pickup to the medical examiner's office to transport them by the hundreds.
Imagine how many cremated remains are down there if they keep them for 10 years.
The answer is a lot. The medical examiner's office wouldn't say how many they're storing now, but they say since 2010, they've cremated about 250 unclaimed bodies a year. And what shocks Durin the most is that unlike some counties that charge for cremains, Philadelphia offers them at no cost. Still, so many stay untouched for years. Smallnack points out that most of the time, unclaimed cremains are buried in a closed potter's field, like Hart Island in the Bronx, mass graves with no headstones, and sometimes no public access. Or they can be donated to nature.
Each county makes their own decisions about how the deceased are disposed of, and in some places their ashes are actually just scattered at sea or over the mountains and that kind of thing. So sometimes there's not even a burial place, you know, should the family be found later.
Finding the family later is something that resource-strapped cities and counties struggle with. That's where Unclaimed Persons steps in. A group of DIY detectives and volunteer genealogists around the country who search to find next of kin. Minnesota-based Janice Martin is the director of the group.
We believe that everybody has a story to tell and every life's worth remembering, and we want families to know what's happened to their family members.
So Martin and her army of volunteers mix deep Googling with cross-checking other public databases, along with cold calls to potential relatives to cast about for clues. Unclaimed Persons is now on its 762nd case. 3 out of 4 of those were solved. Back at Laurel Hill Cemetery, Durin offered this advice to anyone who picks up the remains of a loved one from the medical examiner's office.
You should never take him home and leave him at home.
To be sure, Durin's in the cemetery business, so he might be biased. But he says it's easy for remains just sitting around at a house to quickly become undignified.
Because you start off on the mantelpiece and then you end up in the floor, and then you end up in the basement, and then you end up in the garage, and then everyone dies and 1-800-GOT-TRASH will come and throw you out.
Durin keeps a detailed list of all the 2,000-plus unclaimed remains buried at Laurel Hill. Often, he says, the mourners at the site have no connection to any of them, but are just bearing witness to those who've passed without much notice. For The Pulse, I'm Bobby Allen.
A lot of people are afraid of dying alone, nobody showing up to claim their bodies. Jewish communities, a long time ago, came up with a system to avoid that kind of problem, to accompany and protect mortal remains. It's called shmirah, the watching over of a body during the time between death and burial. But this ritual also speaks to our spirit and the meaning of life. Here's Todd Bookman.
In the earliest days of shmirah, the problem wasn't thieves, it wasn't people trying to harvest organs, it was rodents.
Yeah, well, okay, critters are something that was a problem.
Adam Levine is a fifth-generation funeral director in suburban Philadelphia. He says, not just rodents, actually.
A fox, a squirrel, a hound, or whatever.
And so the body wasn't to be left alone, or else the remains could be desecrated.
The human body is supposed to be treated with respect.
This is Rabbi Bitzalel Katkovsky. As he explains it, a guardian was brought in, a person to watch over the deceased and shoo away any unwanted visitors. The title given to this person is shomer. And to be a shomer, both in ancient times and today, there's only one rule.
As far as I understand, really the only requirements are that the person be Jewish.
Times, of course, have changed a bit. At funeral homes now, certainly at Levine's funeral home, animals are no longer a concern.
We're a very secure building, and we make sure there's no critters here.
But there's a second element, a more timeless task for the shomer.
There's a soul that everyone has, and with there being a soul, there was a protection to the soul.
Many Jews believe that after a person dies, his or her soul doesn't just vanish. A part of that soul is still with the body, stays with the body, in a kind of limbo until burial. And so the soul is watched over too. It needs to be guarded and soothed as it makes its transition.
Yeah, that's why even nowadays, since there is no reason of the predators, right, we still have that aspect of the spiritual respect of a body, right? As in Hebrew called kovod ha'meis, the respect to the deceased.
To show that respect, the body and soul aren't to be left alone, even in the overnight hours. In modern times, the shomer, or shomeret if it's a woman, is brought in after the funeral home staff has left for the day. They don't sit in the morgue. They're usually located in an adjoining room.
Typically, our custom here is when you have a shomer, that shomer stays in one room, doesn't leave, doesn't move. We have one room that has a bathroom, has a phone, has a sink, has a little refrigerator with a bottle of water, and you have your psalms.
The shomer spends his evening reciting the King David Psalms, 150 melodic poems, not necessarily read in any order, but done with focus and gravity. Adam Levine says you form a bond through the process, a connection with the deceased, even if you didn't know them when they were alive.
It's intense. It's intense.
Reciting the Psalms, serving as a shomer, is considered a mitzvah, a good deed, a charitable act in the Jewish community.
Yes, it is a very respected activity because not everybody is able to come to do it, right, due to some people are scared and to stay overnight with the body in a closed place, and especially funeral home. So yeah, it's highly respected, yes. You feel tired. Yeah, you feel tired by spending the whole night. But of course, there's a certain good feeling that the soul will be benefited definitely from your services and feel certain relief.
Special thanks to Rabbi Bitzael Katkowski and Adam Levine of Joseph Levine and Sons Funeral Home. This story was produced by Todd Bookman. We covered a whole lot of ground on today's show, so if you missed anything, want to hear it again, just find us on iTunes. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Alana Gordon, Todd Bookman, and Irina Zhorov. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, Paige Flager the associate producer, Joel Patterson our managing editor, and Megan Pinto our executive producer.
I'm not dead!
What? Nothing. Here's your nine puts.
I'm not dead!
I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Tears will gather in my eyes. Throw my head and cry. As vultures circle in the sky.
you're going to do what you came here to do. So why not do it now? Oh, and cut me down.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and our partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.